Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our great guest co-host, Laurel Sisler. Welcome back to Your Health, Laurel.
Thanks for having me.
How you been doing?
Good. Yeah, good. Doing really well. We got some exciting articles to talk about today.
Yeah, and we're also going to be talking with a really interesting physician and journalist who works at New York Presbyterian, an internist, and also writes for the New York Times about issues that are affecting healthcare right at the cusp of what people know and don't know. I find this really interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting combination of things.
Well, first, let's dive right in on some research that matters. In our very first study, looking at those who drink too much, and what happens when they kind of get advice to cut down or they want to cut down?
Yeah, it is very interesting. So it's a study out of the University of Bristol on nearly 3,000 people who drink and looked at their alcohol use over 6 months and found that about 20% really wanted to cut back on their drinking. But 6 months later, very few had actually cut back as they had intended to do.
So these were not necessarily, they didn't get counseling to quit. It's just that they were all at risk for serious adverse effects from drinking. Perhaps
right.
They drank too much. They drank too often. Right. Maybe they had blackouts, things like that.
So it's looking at the impact of motivation to cut back on cutting back. And not surprisingly, from my perspective, they didn't find much of an impact. This is what we find also with tobacco, is that people who, you know, despite strong desire to cut back or quit smoking, just that desire alone is not enough. And so it's an addiction. It's not simply a behavior that we're talking about.
And this was actually published in the journal Addiction, appropriately yeah. enough. And I guess, you know, what I take from it is that when someone comes into the office and we're seeing them and they say, yeah, I would like to change my behavior, it's not enough to say that's good. We have to follow it up with, okay, let's talk about a plan.
Treatment.
What an interesting light bulb.
Revolutionary concept.
It's not enough to have a light bulb. You have to screw it in.
Yeah. I would just add, too, with alcohol, tobacco, and also opiates, standard of care now is medication. So that, you know, not surprisingly, that wasn't mentioned in this article. So people don't have as much success without that treatment, medications, counseling, the combination of both, ideally.
So if you have a loved one that has these kind of problems, hook them up with treatment, if at all mm-hmm. possible. Let's talk about our next research that matter. And it kind of goes a little bit almost to the end of the spectrum in some respects, which is we know that high intensity treatment for people who aren't exercising and they start exercising gets this really remarkable benefit. Perhaps we don't know quite as much about the benefits of low intensity treatment, like standing up rather than sitting down. And I'm not talking about walking. I'm just talking about standing up.
Yeah. It was really neat. So replacing half an hour of sitting with everyday activity, such as walking, reduces the risk of fatal cardiovascular disease by 24%, which is not insignificant.
Right.
And so that's just half an hour a day from sitting to standing.
I love it. You know, it's like if we just get up and move a little bit, if we're standing, we're expending more energy. If we're walking and doing things, what a very novel concept, right?
Yeah. And one of the hats I wear in our weight management program, this comes up a lot. And I'll draw the distinction, too, between exercise having numerous benefits for health, including this one, and even very, very low levels of exercise. But if your ultimate goal is weight loss, then it's quite different. You do really have to ramp up the intensity in order to use exercise as a tool to lose weight.
This was in the journal Clinical Epidemiology. And we'll ask our great friends, the health sciences librarians at the University of North Carolina, to maybe put up some wonderful low-intensity exercises on our website.
And it could be as simple as just standing up.
As just standing up. Let's talk about our very next research that matters. And we're looking at kind of the spectrum of what's known and not known, which is this particular case, the use of a cannabinoid pill that comes from the marijuana plant to use medical marijuana for seizure control. Something that I think a lot of people, including us, are really interested in. Does it work?
Yeah, so this is a phase three, results of a phase three randomized clinical trial that was published in The Lancet and found that the cannabidiol.
Right, we're just going to that marijuana pill.
That marijuana pill, pharmaceutical that is, not medical marijuana, smoking it, that it did have some positive impact in reducing seizures, particularly in people with a specific type of childhood epilepsy called, I'm going to botch this name too, Lennox-Gastaut.
That sounds
good. My French accent.
I liked it. That's really good. It's better than my non-existent exact accent. And this was actually a 14-week randomized controlled trial that had 171 participants from the United States, Netherlands, and Poland who had really pretty treatment-resistant seizures. Before the trial, they had 6 anti-epilepsy drugs on average, and they were still taking 3. And they were having these type of seizures called drop seizures. They just kind of momentarily kind of drop out. And they had 73 seizures per month on average. This is something that really does interfere with their lives. Half of them got this synthetic marijuana pill, and half of them got a placebo, so there was nothing in it. And they were followed again for a little over 3 months. What did they find? A significant
drop.
At the end of the trial, these drop seizures reduced by almost 44% in the synthetic marijuana group, from an average of 71 to 31 at the end, compared to only a 22% reduction in those who took a placebo, from 74 to 56. It's interesting. I mean, people who took a placebo got a little bit better, but significantly better in the synthetic marijuana group. And all seizures decreased, not just the seizures of these drop seizures. So it was a significant improvement. It would appear that it was due to the drug. There were some side effects. There was some additional nausea and additional drowsiness. None of them were categorized as serious. So we wonder, is this ready yet for prime time? I don't necessarily know that, but I do think that increasingly research like this needs to be in the decision-making for lots of people about access to things that could be helpful for them.
Yeah, I agree. And then they make the point, too, just to emphasize that this is a pill, not smoking marijuana, too.
And let's talk about our last research that matters, Laurel. A new approach to actually reducing opioid use, something we're all really looking for, a magic pill. And in this particular case, it was a smoking cessation intervention. Fascinating.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So not only was this particular community-based intervention effective at reducing smoking rates among homeless people, which is particularly difficult, it also reduced their opiate use.
Yeah, this was actually out of Ottawa, and they've had some of the most interesting, innovative work I've seen in years on some of their community-based tobacco initiatives. And they were applying some of this community-based tobacco initiatives to see, did it kind of have a spillover effect? If you get people peer support and help them access housing and food and manage some of their mental health and stress.
And nicotine replacement therapy.
You can get them to quit smoking, but they also showed a 20%?
Yeah, almost 20% reduction in use of opiates, such as heroin, fentanyl, and OxyContin.
20% reduction in fentanyl, heroin, and OxyContin.
Right. And their cigarettes reduced from 20 a day to an average of 9 a day at the study's end.
Ding, 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 ding. Policymakers, take note. This is really important.
Yes.
Well, that's conclude research that matters today. These are really important research. I hope that they stimulate conversations at your homes. They'll stimulate conversations at our homes as well. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we're going to be talking with physician and journalist Dr. Dhruv Kular about really important issues that he's writing about on Healthcare Horizon. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. We're going to be talking with physician and journalist, Dr. Dhruv Kular, about his experience as a journalist and as a physician, really about the important issues facing the American public in healthcare. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Kular.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in medicine? How did you get interested in journalism?
So the bulk of what I do is still seeing patients day in and day out, and I've always felt strongly about making that kind of the core of what I do on a day-to-day basis, even as kind of my interests have evolved into health policy and journalism as well. So I grew up in Ohio. My dad was a physician. He's a gastroenterologist. I'd always been around medicine, and I loved the stories that he would tell at the end of the day. And so it inspired me at a very young age to get involved in healthcare and medicine. And then I think as I continued on that journey during medical school and residency, I came to see how many different parts there were to health. It wasn't just the clinical aspect of things that we were providing patients, but there were so many social issues that contributed to the kind of health that my patients had. There were policy issues. There were issues of trust. There were issues of family. And so all these factors that were contributing to how my patients ultimately fared, it really inspired me to look beyond just what I was doing in the clinic or just what I was doing in the hospital to look at some of these broader issues as well.
Really interesting. I wanted to first have you talk a little bit about your most recent piece in the New York Times about healthcare and personal responsibility. It's a really interesting topic. Can you give our listeners a little bit of a context behind the concept of personal responsibility in healthcare?
Sure. So the concept of personal responsibility, I think, is a very complicated one because, as I was talking about, there's so many issues. There's so many parts of our daily lives that fit into how we do health-wise. And so some of those things are in our control, exercising or eating right, the decision to try to abstain from unhealthy habits. Much of those things are within our control, but many of the things aren't in our control. And so our genes contribute, the environment contributes, our work contributes. And so it's a very tricky concept, but the basic idea of individual responsibility or personal responsibility for health is that if we engage in healthy lifestyles, if we are patients who take our medicines, if we eat right, if we exercise, if we do the things that we know, and if we save money for our own medical care, then we'll feel better, we'll spend less, we'll reduce our personal burden on others. And that's kind of the way that this idea has been framed in the policy debates as well. And so we're seeing more of this discussion of can we inject personal responsibility into healthcare from people on both sides of the political spectrum. And so it's something that I want to dive into and see, hey, is there actually any evidence that this works or this helps, or does this at times actually hurt patients in the long run?
You know, I've been working with tobacco users and those who are addicted, and Laurel does so much work with those who are morbidly obese. This is at the heart and the crux of the type of issues that you're writing about and looking at, right? As can we just tell them, you need to lose weight, you need to quit smoking? Laurel and I are looking at each other and we're both shaking our heads. It doesn't work that way.
Right. And I think that's exactly right. And that's one of the lessons that we've seen over time is that we all exist in a very complex environment. And so the food that we eat, the food that's available to us, the extent to which we can engage in some of these behaviors is shaped by how we live and where we live. And so it's not often enough just to say, eat healthier or stop smoking. These things are very complicated and they're part of the environment that we live in. And one of the things that I think about and I tried to point out in the article is that, you know, American life expectancy, for instance, and life expectancy across the world has increased tremendously over the last half century, over the last century. And I don't think very many people would say, hey, it's because Americans or other people around the world are now exercising willpower and they are engaging in more healthy behaviors, and that's what's contributed to us living longer over the last few decades. It's a lot of the other things that we've done in our environment. We've made things safer for people. We've increased sanitation. We have introduced vaccinations. There's a lot of things that we've done on a societal level that have helped us live longer and healthier lives. And I think a small part of that may be personal responsibility, and it's reasonable to encourage good behavior. That's a good thing. But at the same time, penalizing people for the opposite is probably counterproductive in the long run.
You talked a little bit about the evidence behind injecting personal responsibility into our healthcare system. Break it down a little bit. What is the evidence for and against?
Sure. So, you know, one of the experiments that I tried to highlight, one of the recent experiments, was in Medicaid in West Virginia. And the reason that I chose to talk about this particular example is because a lot of what's being discussed in at federal policy these days is, can we introduce some of these ideas of personal responsibility into Medicaid programs around the country? So I chose to focus on this one example in 2007, when West Virginia basically asked people who were eligible for Medicaid to sign what they called personal responsibility agreements. And these agreements required a few things. They required people to keep their medical appointments, to take their medications, to avoid visiting the emergency department if they didn't need to participate in certain health screenings. And if they were able to adhere to this agreement, they got enhanced benefits. They got better prescription drug coverage, they got mental health services, they got nutrition programs. But if they didn't, they had those benefits limited in a pretty significant way. And so you were only able to, for instance, get 4 prescription medications per month instead of maybe what you needed. The other controversial aspect of this program was that adults had to sign on behalf of their children. And so obviously if the child couldn't themselves make it to an appointment, that would be kind of the responsibility of the adult. But children were penalized or rewarded in the same way for the actions of their parents. And ultimately what this experiment showed was that less than 15% of people signed the agreement for enhanced benefits. Less than 15% went ahead and signed the agreement. More than 90% of children had their benefits restricted. Overall, people were more likely to visit the emergency department than they had before. It's possible because they weren't able to get the care that they needed in the clinics, and so they ended up going to the emergency department at higher rates. And there was no improvement in health or in healthy behavior, so the experiment was scrapped in 2010. Now, it's possible that other experiments in the future will do better than this one, but the best examples that we have of trying to inject these types of things into health policy have not been effective thus far.
You note the long history of this concept of personal responsibility. So why do you think we're reticent to say the data doesn't back up its use in policy? And then what do we do?
Well, I think part of this stems not from necessarily from the data. Unfortunately, a lot of it is driven by ideology. And so there may be times and some places in which people could point to, you know, we've injected a certain amount of personal responsibility or individual responsibility, and therefore we're getting the results that we want. By and large, that is not the case. But a lot of this is driven by ideology. And so I think of a philosopher, George Lakoff. He actually discusses how conservatives and liberals have different ideologies when it comes to these types of things. And so he suggests that those on the right, conservatives, have kind of a strict father morality. He thinks of the American family as a big family. And the strict father morality suggests that we should emphasize discipline. We should emphasize self-reliance. Everyone should kind of take care of themselves. On the other hand, liberals think of this as more of a nurturant parent view. So they think every member cares for every other member, and everyone else is cared for everyone else. And so when this comes to things like policy, like I mentioned, or for instance, something like a soda tax. So both liberals and conservatives would agree that we should drink less soda, we should drink less sweetened beverages. Conservatives would argue this responsibility primarily falls on the individual to exercise individual willpower. Liberals would probably say soda taxes are an important part of this, but that would be the opposite on the other end of the spectrum. And so a lot of this, I think, is driven more than by ideology than it is by evidence most of the time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. But we're going to take a short break. And I know when we come back, Laura and I want to kind of talk also about another piece of your interest and work, and maybe how this kind of personal responsibility kind of leads us into some views about the trust and the maybe declining trust in healthcare that seems to have some impacts. So we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Dhruv Kular, a journalist, a physician, about what's happening on the healthcare horizon. You're listening to Your Health We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. We've been talking with physician and journalist Dr. Dhruv Kular about a few important issues in healthcare today. And I wanted to circle back. We were talking about the evidence for and against injecting personal responsibility into healthcare. And I wanted to just add one follow-up question about the strategies that you use in advocating for your patients.
Sure. I think, you know, whenever we're thinking about advocacy, there's many different prongs to doing advocacy work. And so some of that is grassroots activism within one's community, within a hospital, within a clinic. Some of that takes on the form of producing original research, producing new knowledge that informs policy debates, that informs political debates. Some of that takes on the form of communicating effectively about these issues, whether that's speaking out on programs like this, whether that's writing for various newspapers and magazines. And so I think there's a number of different ways that one can advocate for what they see as the right way to move forward on this. One thing that I feel strongly about in the midst of some of these partisan political debates is keeping the patient at the center of everything that we do and everything that we talk about, to understand that our role, at least I see my role as a clinician, as a physician, as someone that is protecting the interests of my patients and what I see day in, day out in the hospital, what they go through in their lives. I want to bring that to the forefront because, you know, every stakeholder within the healthcare system seems to have a lobby. And I think too often the patient's voice is the one that is being dismissed.
And we should tell our listeners, Dr. Kular, in addition to being an author, takes care of complex inpatients as an internist at New York Presbyterian. So this comes from experience. And I wonder, you know, you talk about your role and your job, and it's really admirable. And I can't help but think, you know, what would your father say? Because we're also faced at a time in where, and you've written about this as well, about how trust in the medical profession seems to be declining. And maybe it's really different how you have to operate in a system and maybe how your dad did.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is different in the sense that my dad has been treating patients for decades in more of a suburban rural environment in Ohio. I'm now based in New York and was previously in Boston. But one of the things that I loved hearing about when he would come home at the end of the day was not just the specifics of what he had done that day. He's a gastroenterologist, so a lot of what he was doing was colonoscopies and endoscopies. I always found the technical aspects interesting, but the relationships that he developed with his patients over the course of years, that was always what was most special hearing about his day. When a patient he had known for years came in, thanked him for something that he had done or referred one of their family members to him, I thought that there was no greater compliment that a physician could receive than a patient or a doctor wanting their loved one to be cared in the same way as you cared for them. And that continues to be an inspiration for me going forward. So I enjoy learning about new medicines, new drugs, new procedures. I like thinking about the way that we should organize medical care to make it more efficient and more effective. But at the end of the day, developing that level of rapport, developing that level of trust with our patients, I think is something that is incredibly valuable and not always widely discussed.
This is a nice segue to your other recent writing piece about, unfortunately, the declining level of trust that Americans seem to have in the healthcare system. Can you tell us a little bit about that piece?
Sure. So part of the motivation for this piece was not just the declining levels of trust in the healthcare system, but really in American institutions more broadly. And I think in this political moment, what we see is that all institutions, whether that's the government or media or healthcare or certain religious organizations, they've really seen a decline in the trust that Americans place in them. And I think that's really problematic from a social perspective, from an economic perspective, and obviously from a health perspective. So what we don't often recognize is that trust allows us to do all sorts of things in our everyday lives. So we can work, we buy things, we sell things, we vote, and we expect that our behavior will be treated with fairness. And so it kind of facilitates all sorts of interactions that we're having every single day in our lives. And in healthcare, I think it really is the cornerstone of everything that we do. And so the doctor-patient relationship, the clinician-patient relationship, it is rooted in trust. And once trust starts to decline over time, we lose a lot of our ability to affect people's lives and care for them in the way that we want to. And I don't think it's something that we talk about nearly enough. And so that's why I wanted to write this article to bring some attention to the issue.
You know, it's interesting. I've been fortunate enough to be able to do some research in the last few years looking at actually credibility in this case of the Food and Drug Administration as it relates to its tobacco regulatory mission. Mm-hmm. And we found that there were three factors that seemed to impact this. One was this trust, which was moderately high, but yet people didn't know about that mission so much. The second was expertise. And the third was kind of acting in the public interest. So I love this part that you're talking about and having us all talk about these organizations. And it seems like when you get down to a very specific mission, some organizations can have very high trust and credibility and expertise because they are acting in the public mission. People believe it, and others may have more difficulty.
Right. I think that's an excellent point. And one of the things that I wanted to highlight in the article as well, when we're thinking about rebuilding trust or maintaining trust, the questions that people ask are precisely the ones that you alluded to. And so people's trust depends on our answers to a few questions. And the first is, do you know what you're doing? Are you competent in what you're doing? People want to have a sense that whoever they're placing their trust in, that person or that organization is effective and competent. The second is, will you tell me what you're doing? And so you may be competent, but I also want to have some insight into what you're doing. So it's not enough that you are just competent. I want you to be transparent as well. And the third is, are you doing whatever you're doing to help me, or are you doing it to help yourself? And so people want to know that the motives for whatever you're proposing, the agenda you're moving forward, the medication you're prescribing, the recommendation that you're offering, that motive is in my interest, not in your own self-interest. So I think when we're thinking about how we're going to start rebuilding trust in our institutions, we need to think about answering, do you know what you're doing? Will you tell me what you're doing? And are you doing it to help me, or are you doing it to help yourself?
It's really interesting thinking about the last one. I think as healthcare professionals, we do the first two pretty good, but maybe the last one, talking about motives, is not as common and helpful. I'm curious about recent examples that you have of institutions who are either doing that rebuilding of trust really well or perhaps not so well.
Sure. I think when we're thinking about rebuilding trust, to the extent that institutions can do a few things. So as you talked about the last part, are you doing it to help yourself or help me? Part of that is some institutions are adopting much stronger policies that require people to disclose conflicts of interest. And so that kind of thing has been shown to increase patients' trust because they know when you're pushing a certain procedure, when you're pushing a certain device, when you're pushing a certain medication, that's not based on some kind of conflict of interest. So that's one thing I would say. The next is you want to try to create expectations for longer term relationships. And so it's not people generally don't trust as deeply when they think this is just a one-off experience. And so to the extent that we can try to ensure that people are having longer term relationships with the same organization or the same physician, that can be very helpful. And the third is trying to increase transparency. And so there's been studies and of organizations when you make medical notes, for instance, more transparent, when people have more access to their medical records, when their medical notes, when they have a say in correcting things that are wrong in the notes, for instance, that can really help to start build trust. So these are the types of tactical things that organizations have done and can do to try to start rebuilding some of that trust going forward.
Let me ask you kind of a final question in thinking towards the future, Dr. Kaur. in the past, we were paid in for service, the fee-for-service model. And it seems as if some of the things that we've done to increase trust are to disclose some of those relationships and potential conflicts. The more we do, the more we build, the more we make. That right. sometimes is good for patients, maybe sometimes isn't. It seems in the future that model is actually gone the other direction. We're trying to cut and hold costs down, and that at times will be doing less. Now, doing less hopefully is doing better, but how do we disclose the arrangement where physicians perhaps get paid at some levels by doing less, more?
Sure. So this is one of the big issues and the kind of the crux of payment reform for physicians in the United States is that you don't necessarily want physicians to have an interest in only doing more and more and more. And that's what you're talking about in terms of fee for service. And it's been likened to kind of giving, you know, in the same way we give barbers a financial interest to cut your hair, you don't want to give a surgeon the same interest in that sense. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, there have been organizations that have moved fully towards capitation. And so that is when organizations are paid to care for a population of patients and manage their care over the course of some kind of time period. And there was actually quite a backlash to that in some places, like in California during the 90s with HMOs. And so part of what people had perceived to be the problem there was that people were cutting corners or they were restricting care or restricting access to certain types of care just to save money. And so those two ends of the spectrum have been quite difficult, and I think patients rightfully are skeptical of both types of payment models at times. They've both worked well at times, but they've both also worked poorly at times. I think to the extent that we can find some middle ground where doctors are incentivized to provide the care that is most high-value care but cut out care that is low-value care, that's the most effective way to go about this. That is a very tricky thing to do, and we're still trying to figure out how to do it. One example of this is something called bundled payments. And so clinicians, surgeons, other doctors, they're paid to provide a group of services around something like a hip surgery. So everything for those 90 days or 120 days around the surgery, the pre-op, the scans, the MRIs, the surgery itself, and the rehab afterwards is included in one price for that thing. And so some people think that that's kind of a middle ground between getting paid for every little service or getting paid for the whole population of patients. Something like bundled payments can help us bridge the gap.
That's a really nice a place to probably put a bookmark. Thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Kaur.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
You know, I think your patients should be very fortunate, and hopefully they're very trusting to understand that you're thinking about these issues, and maybe you'll be a guest again on Your Health to follow up some of these really important questions.
Thanks very much. I'd love to.
We're going to take a short break. But coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisser. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Laurel and I can spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, Laurel, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about someone who has found out that their son is using combustible tobacco and smoking.
We just found out that our 15-year-old son has started smoking. Obviously, we're upset. Part of me just wants to lock him up and throw away the key, but I realize that's likely not the best way to combat this for his long-term health. What do you recommend?
Maybe you could lock him up and just hold on to the key. Yeah, I think that would work, Laurel.
Probably not.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So Laurel is the empathetic one of the group here, and she supervises people who actually treat about 3,000 tobacco users a year. So yes. What do you recommend here?
You know, it's interesting. I more often see adults, and our team more often sees adults, in which case the real bottom line is getting them in to have some counseling. So talking about, you know, why they're smoking, what things they could do differently, getting some behavioral treatment, and then also medications in adults that really help with withdrawal symptoms and increase people's chances of quitting by quite a bit. Now, with teenagers, it's a little different. There's not as much research on using medications to help them quit, but definitely behavioral counseling and getting them in to see a specialist. If they're local here, coming to our UNC Nicotine Dependence Program would be a great place to start.
And there's free resources in every state in the country.
Yes.
By calling 1-800-QUIT-NOW, quit now. And the thing about this is that while it's 15 and just started, the likelihood of becoming addicted goes up dramatically even after like a half a pack of cigarettes. And so
yeah.
There's a good chance that the addictive aspects have started coming into play here, even the brain chemistry that can begin to change. But that becomes so much stronger and longer as it goes on. So I would take it seriously.
Yeah, they're smart to be taking it.
The likelihood of having other problems goes up dramatically. So if you begin to use cigarettes, you might well begin to experiment with other unhealthy behaviors and other addictive behaviors. So I think it's good. Get in there, fight it out, slug it out, but be on the same team. I think forming and letting your son know that you care and you want him to get some help.
I agree.
Thanks so much for that great question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My mother-in-law was just diagnosed with cancer and she wants to try a ketogenic diet. What is that and is there any evidence that they work?
So sorry to hear the news of cancer. That's always upsetting. And we always strongly encourage people to really do take control of their health and make changes that are healthy.
Yeah, including a lot of fundamental pieces of the ketogenic diet is eating mostly whole foods, unprocessed foods, foods in their
whole
natural
grains,
form
fresh fruits,
that
vegetables.
They come. Yeah. And so I think that those are all really good things that will undoubtedly have a positive impact on your health and there's no side effects.
As to evidence that following a ketogenic diet per se or specific proprietary-based diet like that is going to reduce the likelihood that you're going to get another cancer or improve the outcome of the cancer, that's a different piece. We don't really have that type of data yet.
We don't. There's some case reports and things like that, but not the quality of data that we talk about in this program.
We do know that those sorts of diets, particularly kind of the Mediterranean, fresh fruits and nuts, and those sorts of things have all kinds of benefits for cardiovascular disease prevention and for losing weight frequently and just a better lifestyle. So kudos for you for taking charge. Laura, what's our very last house call?
Our 13-year-old daughter is on social media for hours a day. We've also noticed that it seems to affect her self-esteem. How can we help her develop good social media habits and healthy responses to the often destructive conversations that seem to be happening there?
Boy, this is not good. Because we assume that the increase in social media has gone along with decreased self-esteem. I don't think it goes the other direction. None of the data that I've seen. And we know this is a big problem and that she could be subject to all kinds of things like bullying that is really prevalent on social media.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I would start to think, see if she's able to pick out that pattern on her own. If you start to ask her about, I've noticed you've been, sounding kind of down recently. What's that about? She might not pick up on that on her own at 13. So you might have to be a little bit more direct and ask if something's going on online.
Yeah. And I think as a parent, you do what you need to do to protect your child.
Yeah.
And setting limits right here, there's some limits here. If you're on social media at age 13 for several hours a day, and I know that may be a lot of teens that are, but there needs to be limit setting in the house, access to computers, access to social media, access to, phone. Phone is a privilege. Knowing what your child is putting out on social media, and I think it's wise to be a friend of your child or your teen here. And that requires really, I think, some skill. So, yeah. But to be aware of and looking and sharing and talking, boy, this is a scary world out there. And unless you know, it's very hard to intervene.
And having real world, IRL, in real life connections as well, not just online.
Well, thank you for your questions. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. If you have any question you want to send it to yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or use our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine and UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my great guest co-host, Laurel Sistler, and our guest today, Dr. Drew Kular. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Laurel Sistler.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.